And we have a guest here today that's going to explain what's going on.
Good morning. My name is Steve. I'm with UKPR. And I don't know if you all, some of you all might know, Dr. Cooper has been awarded a Great Teacher Award. And so applause is appropriate for that.
They might not understand why I would get that my last week's
Well, same. My students would get it. Yeah, it's not insane. But I'm a videographer, and I am charged every year. They name six great teachers. They're nominated by students. Nominate your favorite teachers, by the way, with the Alumni Association. They get a little stipend. They get recognized on the floor of Ruth Arena at a basketball game. You know it's a big deal then because of that. And so I'm charged with making a little short mini documentary about each teacher, all six of them. And so I'm going to just sort of do video while you all have class. Is there anybody who does not want to be in the video? I can try to shoot around you. Cool. The best thing you can do is to ignore me. That is all.
And I forgot to be here today.
I would have
worn jeans. I would have called them yesterday.
I would have worn slacks or something. We'll just cut it off. So we have a couple things that we want to go over. Is first, we're going to try to cover this that article, the PDF that I put up online. We kind of went through everything else about anaerobic and aerobic glycolysis, right? And TCA cycle, electron transport chain. Everybody kind of okay with that, right? Good. So we'll try to go over some of the main highlights with this, but also we want to talk about what do we want to cover maybe next, because we'll finish this beginning part about cellular metabolism. Do we want to, I think, it could be interesting to hit the next part about maybe membrane function, right? Because then that could lead us into other things about temperature, sensory, muscle. And some of it is review from 350 or Animal Phys or Bio-142 that you might have had a long time ago or some other physiology course. But maybe we can cover that a bit more in depth now on some of the properties of membrane physiology, right? So let's go through what we were planned to do. And then maybe we'll move over to membrane physiology. I'll also copy that chapter out, chapter 6, and send that to you. I can't copy the whole book, but I'll get chapter 6. And if you've had 350, you probably know some of that content as well. But we'll try to go a little bit more in depth, a little bit more in depth than what's in the textbook as well. But we'll try to record everything that we're doing. And of course, if I may have PowerPoints, I'll share them with you, but it might be more on the board, right? Okay, so let's kind of keep going with where we are, and I'll send you a link. I don't know what's going to happen next week with the weather. Tuesday we're meeting next week, but if they can't clean the streets and we still have cancellation on Monday, maybe we'll be ready for Tuesday, but just stay tuned. You get emails, right? And I put everything on the web, and everybody's getting the emails, right? You're getting spam, filter spam folder, okay, right? Okay, good. Alrighty. So, can you see that okay? Should I bring it down maybe
a little bit?
And if you have it on your, if you've uploaded your PDF, then you can see, is that okay? Yeah. And, okay. So there was some, I don't know if you've, hopefully you've looked through this already. let's bring this up a little bit. And when we start to talk about membrane physiology, I'll have more of a PowerPoint listed on notes because, as you know, we have to be better teachers for these teaching awards, right? I just can't ramble on. So, you know, it's like, you know, after I write letters, nobody pays attention anymore. All right, so hopefully you've looked at some of this in there, and I've highlighted a few key points that I want to mention about. Remember we were talking about anaerobic metabolism, and that you a lot in the textbooks generally you hear about you don't really get much energy out of the anaerobic metabolism because glycolysis only has how many ATP as a total? Two, right? Net is two, but they make four ATP, but use two, so the net ATP is two, right? And then you get it through the TCA cycle, electron transport chain, and you make more ATP. And I think we covered it last time. If we don't have oxygen as electron acceptor, then the whole system backs up, right? So this is what we were talking about. But there's exceptions to this, and this is what we want to cover in this content. So down here, we've talked about a little bit about this pathway right here is kind of interesting, and alternative pathways that are used in the TCA cycle without oxygenation, so it's not backing up. And I find this really kind of amazing, because if you look at this next figure right here, and I brought this up in 350 class before, here's your cytoplasm glycolysis that would go on normally, but look at the intermediate C here. You get down to oxaloacetate and malate. Malate can go into the mitochondria, and now you can use this malate cycle, which is really quite interesting, because what happens here is you make ATP, and you're using the pathways inside of the TCA cycle, right? Same enzymes, but you don't need the oxygenation, and it's not backing up and inhibiting because of lack of oxygen. Because some of the steps that I think we went through that about in the TCA cycle, the negative feedback process, right? Some of the steps in the TCA cycle are inhibited by too much NADH or ATP. So that's the negative feedback process. Some of the enzymatic steps are actually enhanced by ADP that's present. So ADP is the, you know, ATP broken down to ADP plus inorganic phosphate. And then we see that actually that ADP can actually stimulate enzymes to function. So there's your kind of like a positive, you know, approach to make more ATP. And then the other steps are actually inhibited by ATP or NADH or FADH2, so you don't just make a lot of ATP, you know, all at once. So it's regulated. But here in this process, this is interesting because we don't see, at least I couldn't find, where these enzymes here are actually inhibited or by NADH or FADH2. So that means that this can keep going on, which is really quite interesting. The end product here, utilizing anaerobic metabolism, using glycolysis, and then using this malate pathway, generally you get 6 ATP out of it, compared to 32 or 34 utilizing the whole process, right? So you can still get more ATP than just using glycolysis alone. So that's pretty interesting, and this article covers a little bit of that content. Specifically, they cover a lot about this enzyme right here, PEPCK, because that's one that's used as a marker for these processes. So that's kind of interesting. All right, that was that part. So I found that to be really neat. And then there's some other really interesting pathways. Oh, that one was covering some worms. Let's see which worm that was. That's the palamenthi worms that can actually utilize that process. Yeah. Max?
Going back with the malate, mm-hmm. How difficult is it for it to transport across the membrane for the mitochondria?
I have no idea, but it will, and I don't know, it doesn't seem like in here that they're showing that it took energy to do that, right? So it didn't take ATP. Where some cases you could actually see where it would probably, like what we talked about with NADH, coming into the mitochondria took ATP, so that's why you reduce one ATP equivalent instead of three, you get two from that, right? So this is kind of the idea. So I don't know that. But we see here, NADH going to NAD from this conversion, right? So that took something away from NADH being able to be used for energy. So that might be part of that process. All right, and here's another pathway that's pretty cool. So this was in bivalves and cephalopod mollusk. And here's, which we've already talked a little bit about this before. Let's see if I can get this up. Aspartate, and you remember the alpha-ketoglutarate in the TCA cycle we talked about? That's so interesting because you can have glutamate going to alpha-ketoglutarate, and you can have alpha-ketoglutarate going to glutamate, and that's just wild because that could go into your nervous system and help you as a neurotransmitter as well. So that's pretty cool. But here we see this other kind of cycling here, alpha-ketoglutarate to glutamate, but now we're looking through another pathway. Here's this pyruvate that we have talked about before, and lactate as the byproduct. But here we go through making propionate, and we can get some more ATP out. So here's another anaerobic process that some animals are using to make ATP, and they don't need oxygen. So we kind of have to change our mindset about thinking about anaerobic metabolism, that it won't take place without oxygen. So it's these, you know,
you generally get taught the main things, and then you start to find out there's exceptions, and then we find out we really don't know much about lots of things. All right. Oh, we did have arginine phosphate stores. We did talk a little bit about energy stores and other forms instead of just ATP. Remember we talked about creatinine phosphate, right? Did we mention that? Because I'm teaching 352 in an honor section, so I'm trying to figure out what I said in your class versus the other class. But also using arginine phosphate, you can get energy with that phosphate that comes off of creatinine phosphate, arginine phosphate. It depends which animal might, what type of animal is using pretty much what pathway. I think we talked about supplements. People can take supplements, creatinine phosphate, right? And there's some real valid literature behind that about helping with energy stores. Yes? Would you utilize that more because you have that reserve? Could you bypass something else and use more of the creatinine phosphate? I don't know. That'd be interesting to find out, you know, see what happens. A lot of things have those feedbacks, as you might know. People that take steroids, for example, right? And like cortisol, things like that. Some people take it for asthma. And then what's going to happen to your endogenous production of that? It starts to drop on your adrenal. Does anybody remember adrenal cortex or adrenal medulla for glucocorticoids?
Cortex.
Cortex, exactly, right. Adrenal medulla, nervous system, norepinephrine, epinephrine, right? Adrenal cortex, mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, cortisol. So people that take injections of cortisol, for example, their cortex starts to atrophy. And then when they go cold turkey off of it and then have a stressful response, their body can't make as much. So I would doubt that you have a trade-off. Sounds pretty good. And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe in those, like we were talking about the migratory birds that use creatinine phosphate and they were sampling them, you wonder if they're not, when they deplete the creatinine phosphate, if they're starting to use the other pathways more so. And, you know, maybe so. Has anybody seen what they're doing with the some of the athletes? You know, I'm swimming these days. I'm trying to get better at swimming. And I'm still like, you know, I get to the end of the pool, I'm out of breath, and these other people that are on swim teams, they're just going back and forth. There's this gal that swims with us, so this is like adult swimming, 6 a.m. in the morning, Monday, Thursday, Saturday it's 7 a.m., so it's a lot better. It's an outdoor pool, it's really wild, and but the pool water's warm, but some of these people are just like going back and forth. And I'm just getting to the other end, and this person's like there and back already, and I'm just like, God, how do you do this? But they're so well trained. The one person that swims with us is on the center swim team, and she's a mermaid. She's a mermaid, so she can just go back and forth. And talking about trying to get better at not being so driven, like, you know, I'm feeling like I'm hypoxic all the time. And they said, well, you have to learn to swim underwater for a longer period of time, more strokes, like 3-4 strokes before you come up to surface, before you, you know, take a breath. And just condition your body more and more and more. And it's kind of like, oh yeah, okay. So it's like going to altitude, Colorado Springs, you know, with the Olympics. I'm never going to get, you know, this level because I can't be conditioned that well, probably. But I've seen runners, and the coach was talking about this, runners, you know, joggers, that actually tape their mouth up because they just want to be nose breathers. And that actually helps them to be more anaerobic so they can increase their red blood cell count. It's kind of like going to altitude, right? Anybody ever hear of anything like that? Have you heard of anything like that? This is like, I was blown away by that. So I didn't believe my coach. I thought he was just messing with me. And so I looked it up on YouTube, and I'm just like, you got to be joking. People are doing that, right? But that's going to help them in the long run. So I told my coach, maybe for a little bit, but I'm going to poke some holes in there so I can still breathe. But, you know, there's lots of things that are out there. Yes, Julie.
So does breathing through your nose, like, do you utilize oxygen better doing that? Because when I was a runner, they'd always say, like, breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth.
Yeah.
Was there, like, is there
just being a total nose breather.
Does that, like, I know that helps for, like, facial development and all that stuff, but, like... I don't know. Like, I just want to.
And here it was all about, I think, being hypoxic and trying to get yourself more endurance training.
Okay.
Yes.
I know that breathing through your nose is more efficient because it's better, like, cleaning the air in your hand.
Okay.
So, like Ben was saying on some of the swimming, is actually to, you know, when you come up, breathe through your mouth. And when I first started out, I was really bad at swimming. So I tried the triathlon. It was a disaster. I thought the running's not bad, the biking's not bad. The swimming was a total mess up. It was horrible. So this is why I joined the master swimming team here in town, to learn how to do this more efficiently. And then the coach the first day said, "You're not a swimmer, are you?" I said, "No." He said, "First of all, we got to teach how to breathe when you swim." And just like what you're saying, what he's saying is, when you come up for your breath, don't try to fill up your whole lungs. Just take half a breath, kind of. But when you're in the water, blow out, and then when you come up, you're ready to go. I was taking a breath, and he said, "No, you're not being efficient." But I'm too afraid to blow out because I don't know when your head's going to come back up, right? But as soon as you started training doing this, oh my gosh, I can only do 8 laps at the UK pool. I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and I was done. And that was 25 yards. I can get up to 3,000 yards now. But, I'm stopping at the edge of the pool. I'm not doing those flips. That's crazy. But the endurance, I started from July, and the coach is saying, "Well, you finally learned how to breathe. You just now have to learn how to do a butterfly swim." I'm thinking, nope, that's okay. With the stay with freestyle. So I think it is working, and I think these conditionings could help you. I'm not wanting to get muscle samples taken and find out what's going on with my enzymes. But anyway, some people do that. All right. So that's kind of interesting about that point. And then there's some other pathways that are really interested. You make acetate as a byproduct, but you can actually break that down. And ethanol dehydrogenase, and possibly get some ethanol. Certain animals can do these kind of things. But bacteria, the text kind of goes through some of the bacteria as well as animals. So this is a little bit of an interesting process. What is this other step that was really interesting? Oh, alcohol, if you have too much alcohol, what's the problem is that you break down that alcohol dehydrogenase, and you get a ketone products, right? And so what's one of the aspects not to get these ketones that are produced that are toxic is that you actually block that, you can try to block that enzyme, and that way it could help you not produce those products. But there's also, what was it? There's another aspect, ethylene glycol. Anybody know where ethylene glycol is being used? Anything? So it's actually used in antifreeze and in your car, right? It's a good time now to check your antifreeze in your car, make sure it's good. And what's really bad is that people add that to their car, and the ethylene glycol goes on the ground, and animals will lick it up, and they'll eat it, and they get toxic because the byproduct from it is really bad. But what breaks down ethylene glycol is alcohol dehydrogenase. And so one thing that they do is actually try to control that by feeding the person, because the ethylene glycol makes a toxic byproduct that can kill you. So what they do in the hospital is actually get you drunk. They give you alcohol to compete with not breaking down the ethylene glycol, so you can try to clear it through renal system instead. Isn't that wild? So don't try that with a police officer if you're drinking. Never drink and drive anyways, but don't try to use that as an excuse that I drank ethylene glycol by mistake. No, that doesn't work. But that's what they might do for a veterinarian, for example, if a dog was eating that ethylene glycol. For some reason it tastes sugary to animals or something like that, and they will drink it. There's been cases with humans actually taking it, alcoholics, because they see that the antifreeze has alcohol in it as well as ethylene glycol, so they drink it for the alcohol, and then they got poisoned from the ethylene glycol. Is that weird enough? Tangent? Yeah, that was pretty weird. Okay. All right, so that's that part. Oh, so here's something that's really interesting on page 62. Many mollusks, especially these intertidal bivalves, like oysters, people like oysters, clams, routinely experience prolonged hypoxia. Some bivalves and oysters can indefinitely, completely in the absence of oxygen, live with totally the absence of oxygen. Is that not wild?
I didn't really think that was possible, but that's pretty neat to think about, right? And you just think about, there's lots of interesting aspects to all this. So if we look at some of these enzymes and how it's being utilized, and what they did is they looked at these fish and looked at their enzyme usage for red and white muscle. So what does this mean? We're going to cover muscle sometime in here. White muscle, what do we talk about generally for white muscle?
Type 2.
Yeah, type 2.
Fast twitch.
Fast twitch muscle, ones you would use for jumping, right? And red muscle, slow muscle, right? Postural muscles. They don't fatigue as fast. They have a lot of mitochondria. And so, and you expect different enzymes in there. So why, if we remember from 350, why do you have red muscle and white muscle? I mean, what gives it the red color? Why do we call it red? We're getting away from that nowadays because we call it type 1 or type 2 or different types of muscle in that aspect. But why is red muscle red? Anybody remember? If you took a chicken and opened it up and you could see red muscle in there. Kind of. But you're on the right track. So red muscle, since it's tonic and being used all the time, you get a good vascular system to it. And then mammals, right, use red blood cells, so red blood cells to it. And then that's interesting. But myoglobin is like hemoglobin, but myo, muscle, is inside of the muscle cell itself. And myoglobin, if we isolate myoglobin and then shine white light on it, it'll look red. And there's something else that'll look red. And I think you're on that aspect, mitochondria itself. If you isolate mitochondria, the cytochromes in there look red. So red muscle has more mitochondria than the white muscle. Plus it has a lot of myoglobin to pull the oxygen into the muscle fiber. So here's our two reasons. And then usually it's more vascular with the capillary beds. And so you see red blood cells, you know, there. So that's red muscle versus white muscle. Pretty cool. Right. You can explain that when you go get chicken at, you know, KFC and see if the person giving you chicken. You can talk about it. But anyways, here we go about the red and white muscle to make sure that you're, you know, kind of generally here. And then it just mentioning about active fish versus inactive fish. Don't try to memorize numbers, but the point here is that you see that this active fish, look at the white muscle, lactate dehydrogenase just skyrockets here. It's really high compared to the red muscle. And this is under anaerobic metabolism, so it's really cranked up to being utilized in a high level of lactate dehydrogenase. So this is units of enzyme activity per moles per minute of gram weight. So they're actually normalizing it to the amount of tissue that they're looking at. So this is how that's being addressed. So the idea is that, yeah, they're pretty efficient. They have a lot of the enzymes that help them with the metabolism for that pathway. So that's pretty neat. Okay, and here's this, we kind of covered some of this already about energy stores in, you know, creatinine phosphate, for example. So this is just mentioning about the concentrations or the unit of concentrations per weight, and that, you know, you can see that creatinine phosphate used, other phosphate groups. We didn't talk about all these, but you can get energy out of these other phosphates as well. So that's kind of neat. And then they look at the intermediates in here that are utilized in anaerobic metabolism. This guy, if I pronounce it right, Hachacha, he was a god in the field of really looking at comparative biochemistry in lots of animals. So really a big name. You'll see his name throughout comparative physiology textbooks when they talk more about metabolism. Okay, so where did this go? Oh, I wanted to get over here. This is really interesting. I don't know if you noticed this. Anaerobic metabolism, these tetrapods, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals, almost completely limited to glycogen utilization and lactate accumulation. So that's pretty neat to think about, you know, that they're going to just use the glycogen, glucose, glycogen, right? It's broken down to glucose and lactate accumulation. And they can't really use a lot of the other pathways that we were talking about. So that's quite neat about different comparative aspects among the different animals. And then the text really goes through a bit about diving animals, which is really quite interesting because a diving seal, a diving bird, whales, for example, a whale can stay underwater for over an hour. Whew. Wow, you know, how do they do that, right? And they look at seals, for example, or even diving birds, and they measure the blood concentration of lactate after they dive, and the lactate levels just increase so much, and their pH drops in their blood. We couldn't handle that, but they could. You know, how is it that their body and their cells can handle that pH drop and lactic acid being so high, where we can't really handle that level? And remember, we talked about pH. As you decrease pH, become more acidic, your cells depolarize. So is there something about their cells that is different, that they maybe don't depolarize as much? I'm not aware of studies where they've actually taken out like seal muscle and actually kept it in a dish, put an electrode in it, and measured the membrane potential with an acidic environment. I don't know if that's been done. You know, maybe it has, it's something we can look up. Can they handle it better? Will they not change their membrane potential as much? Is there some other mechanism that's working for them? I can't imagine they have a heart that's beating, right? And pacemaker cells, and you wonder, whew, what's going on with them, right? If anybody's had 350 and you had that wet lab that we had with the water on your face, do you remember that experiment, the, you know, nightmare that you might have had? What was that to teach? What was the point about that lab? Do you remember? Yes, Lauren.
Did it have something to do with like your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system?
Yes, it was a diving response, because just like the diving seal, you have receptors in your face, particularly in your mouth, and that respond to that cold, it needs to be cold water. That happens every time I jump in the UK pool. And then you're kind of like, well, it is that sympathetic response, a little bit of a shock, but you actually decrease your heart rate. Now, initially, this is controversial in the literature because the way they did these experiments is, and we can go through the more details about that, but you will have a this response, a parasympathetic response, is the primary way the textbooks talk about it, but you initially have a sympathetic response. Like when you put your head in there, you probably didn't like that at 350, and your heart rate actually went up a little bit, and then you put your face in the water, and then your heart rate slows down. And you're breathing, if you're not breathing because you're underwater, but what I've mentioned for 350 is we shouldn't be doing the face in the water, because that's another variable, because you're not breathing, right? Is instead have ice and a cloth and wet the cloth, and then just put that on the face. And that way you're not holding your breath, because you can still breathe. And that would be taking away that variable of holding your breath. Holding your breath, after a while, you're becoming hypoxic and you're gonna start to have more of a sympathetic response. So that would be a better lab to do for that. I'm trying to convince that we switch over to doing that instead of the head in the water. Diving seals, diving birds, if they put a heart rate monitor on them, they will slow down their heart rate. Even iguanas, you know, the Galapagos Island iguana, people have done studies on iguanas, and they've actually showed that their heart rate drops when they dive, and they're swimming. So they're swimming, and their heart rate drops, and they can't be breathing, right, because water would come in. So what's happening? And their heart rate's slowing down, but they're exercising. You would think you need blood to go to those exercising muscles, right, that are exercising, but it actually slows down. And so they're just having to deal with that more of that lactic and that kind of hypoxic environment in there. Now, what they've done in some of these studies where they realized it was a bit artificial and people tried to do this more realistic, is they were not using trained seals, which they did these initial studies on. It was actually Hatacha up in Canada, Vancouver, Canada. And he used trained seals to dive, and they, you know, had these little monitors on them, and then if they didn't train them, they actually got a little bit different response, like go in the water, right, versus throwing a fish in and having them do this, or just doing it on their own when they were doing their own thing. If they trained them, they actually had this kind of high rate first, and then it would drop, and maybe anticipation of getting that fish food that they're training them with, versus if they were just swimming around and going in the water, they didn't see that initial higher heart rate. So some differences in the way it might be functioning. So we have that diving response too in our face. You could take a class, like our, you know, large class, for example, test them if you're all about the same age levels, and you can tell the non-smokers from the smokers, because the smokers will lose that diving response. You have it really a heavy diving response when you're young, and you start to lose it the older you get, but smokers lose it very quickly. So that's kind of interesting too, because you damage your surface receptors. on your face. So you probably heard of babies that have a traumatic delivery, for example, maybe a C-section or just a normal delivery, and they have what's called supraventricular tachycardia. Supraventricular, above the ventricles, tachycardia. So your atria are beating too fast. And they're beating so fast that they can't get the normal blood into the ventricles. So what they used to do is inject and get a chemical into them to slow it down, right? But what they found out, what was easier, just take a cold rad and put it on the baby's face, ice water on the baby's face. They have a really pronounced diving response, and their heart rate will slow down. They don't need to be injected with any chemical. So it's kind of interesting to think about. It's just, you know, utilizing other pathways that we normally could utilize and slow your heart rate down. So it's kind of interesting. I wonder about other animals. I don't know. How about a cow? How about a sheep? You know, they probably tested them. I have no idea. It'd be kind of a fun project. Should we go out to the farm and we could test some things, right? So it'd be interesting to find out. But diving seals, they've used quite a bit in the literature to understand. So look at these levels right here. Before a dive, after the dive, wow. I mean, this is really kicking up pretty high. And that's, what is it, 70,000 micromolar change in lactic acid that's increased after that dive for the diving seal? That's phenomenal. So how is it that they can handle that is just still a mystery in some aspects, right? So it's really quite amazing. All right. There was another thing that was really interesting about turtles, and I don't know if you've read this yet or not, but in turtles, supposedly this lactic acid really builds up in these freshwater turtles that stay submerged for a long time. And lactic acid will cause the shell to start breaking down so their calcium levels can increase. And calcium is so important for synaptic transmission. But also, lactate can bind the calcium to keep the calcium at a lower level. So it's kind of like a trade-off. It's breaking down the calcium, but then it's binding it up so they don't have so much free calcium around that could alter synaptic transmission, for example, or other aspects. So that's kind of another aspect that you see. It's not just one direction. It's going to have some other impacts on the body as well, and that's quite unique, I think. So this was really quite interesting. But think about this freshwater turtle, 180 days submerged in nitrogen-containing water. So there's no oxygen there, plus turtles don't have gills, right? But they're 180 days in the water without breathing oxygen, and they survive. Isn't it? I mean, that's phenomenal, right? So what's so unique about them? This is pretty interesting to think about. And there's a person I mentioned, I think his name once before, Robert Putman. He passed away a year and a half ago. He was up at Wright State, and he worked in the physiology department and in the medical school, so Wright State Medical School. And he was the world's expert in recording in turtles. And so he used turtles to understand how they can handle this hypoxia, how they could handle not having as much oxygen in their body. Because that's the primary driving response for you to breathe. So how is it that they could handle that? And you know what was going on in their nervous system? Did the nervous system, just those neurons that detect that, were they just firing like crazy? Or was there some kind of feedback process that's inhibiting those neurons from firing so much while they're in this hypoxic state? So that was used as a model. It's kind of like the August Croke principle that we talked about, used as a model to basically understand hypoxia and how the nervous system can handle it. And there's a lot of interesting studies that he came up with, really neat aspects. He actually took the carotid, remember which one is it, carotid bodies, carotid sinuses that detect your pH and CO2.
The artery.
Yep, carotid body, carotid artery, carotid sinuses. Carotid body, carotid sinuses.
Bodies.
Bodies. Because sinus, remember, if you're studying for MCAT, carotid sinuses, sinus headache, carotid pressure, right? So for sinuses is your pressure, carotid bodies, and aortic bodies also. And you have spots in your bottom of your fourth ventricle in your brain that can detect the low oxygen and, or maybe it's actually the CO2 that's being detected as well. But we're really hypoxic driven is the way we are most sensitive, not so much the pH, but it adds to it. Anyways, he did a lot of cell culture. He took this out of turtles. He looked at individual cells and how they could respond in the dish. And that way he was getting more of these mechanisms. we have inside those cells a hypoxic factor that can actually detect hypoxia in a cell, and that can actually change how your DNA will transcription, translation, you know, making different proteins. So it's kind of interesting, the whole process. We can get more into that if we want to get into the cell level of hypoxic-driven aspects in the cell and how you respond to it. But anyways, that was really interesting about that aspect, to try to compensate for the calcium that builds up from the breakdown, or from hypoxia and lactic acid building up. All right. Where are we at? So this chapter kind of jumps all over the place. It's worse than my lectures. Is that they then went into bioluminescence and some other aspects. It's another energy-demanding process, right, basically, for these kind of animals. But there was something interesting about this I wanted to talk about is, oh, yeah, this was really wild. So I think we mentioned it a little bit last time. Did we mention about why we might be using so much ATP? What's the most energy-demanding process, again, in your body? Did we talk about that? Probably the most energy-demanding process in your body right now, just sitting here.
Isn't it? I know your brain is the most energy-intensive.
It's really
neuron activation and things like that.
Yeah, that's good. That's right on the point. But now I'm thinking at the cell level, what is it, the mechanism that why we need that oxygen? What is probably the cellular mechanism that is most important, that's probably driving us to make our ATP? Oxygen and phosphor. Yes, and why do we need that? What are we trying to drive? What are we trying to maintain?
I don't know. It's right. Is it metabolism?
Yes, kind of. It's getting there. And what is it? And then metabolism. What is it that we are? We're trying to make ATP for what reason? What's the main aspect of cells trying to reach a homeostatic process? Well, maybe I'll give you a hint. In both of your eyes, right? You have an optic nerve. That optic nerve has a million neurons in it, so 2 million neurons, right? And we got an action potential in all of those things, right? So it goes up, upstroke, sodium goes into the cell, downstroke, potassium goes out. How do we maintain that? Back to get it back to the normal levels, right? The sodium
refractory
within, potassium.
Period.
Huh?
Refractory period.
Oh, well, that's kind of it. But how do we get the sodium back out and the potassium back in?
Sodium-potassium pump.
Exactly. So probably the most energy-demanding process in your body is ion metabolism. Homeostasis, right? Ion homeostasis. And you just think about those million neurons, 2 million neurons in your eye, and all those action potentials flying through, and then you're having to maintain the sodium-potassium balance. So it's like the most energy-demanding process in your body is really ion maintenance. Right, and a lot of it's the sodium potassium pump. But what I found really interesting in this chapter is that they mentioned that, which was so cool, is that if you looked at insect cells and other animals that are heterotherms, that change with the environmental temperature, their cell membranes aren't as leaky as homeotherms. So homeotherms like us, right, we maintain our set body temperature. But how do we maintain our set body temperature? By metabolism, right? Utilizing, and it's kind of like today, you know, we might be shivering, so we raise our metabolism, right? And what are we doing? Breaking down ATP, right? For that muscle shivering, not really for work, right? To like lift something, but we're just trying to warm up by breaking down ATP and remaking ATP and going back through that process again. But saying that the cells in mammals, or homeotherms, are more leaky, and that drives a higher level of the sodium potassium pump to maintain the ion balance. And that's possibly why then we're able to keep that high metabolism, but also what our body temperature. And I'm just like, well, that was blown away. I mean, I never really thought about that. And then why the other animals, like invertebrates, insects, don't have as leaky of membrane. Because they kind of go with the environment, temperature, right? And they're not trying to maintain that. And I thought that was really cool. So what makes a membrane leaky? Anybody remember what makes membranes leaky? Why do they, how can they, what's leaky mean?
Well, you have like ion channels.
Ion channels?
Leaky ion channels.
Leaky ion channels, because you're not just getting a
by lipid membrane, we're just not getting ions to just move through there, right? They have to move through an ion channel. And we have basically, when I was in school, they would call them just leak channels. And they just named them monovalent cationic leak channels. And you think monovalent, okay, like sodium plus one, potassium plus one. Could that be chloride minus one? But then they said monovalent cationic, so it had to be a plus charge, ions. So it had to be like sodium potassium, right? And so that's what they called them. And they thought it was one unique channel that just allowed sodium to go through and potassium. But now we know that there's specific potassium leak channels called K2P channels. They're K2P because they have two little loops in their structure of the protein, not two channels through there, but two little loops in the membrane. So when they looked at the sequence of the protein, they found that in all of these classifications, what they have called K2P channels. And now they found K2P channels throughout the animal kingdom, and guess what? Throughout the plant kingdom as well. And where they first described them, you wouldn't believe it. Yeast. So they found it in yeast genetics, in the yeast genome, and then they looked at that DNA from the yeast, wow, looked at it on a genomic comparison, they said, well, we don't, what is that thing doing? What is that gene doing in animals? And they found out it expresses the K2P channel, and then they found out, oh, humans have 15 different types of K2P channels. Drosophila, because it got the whole sequence of the Drosophila for flies, they have 11 different types of K2P channels. And how does this all relate? It is bizarre. So K2P channel, it's a potassium channel. They still don't know a single cell how many different types of K2P channels are expressed in a single cell, right? So that's kind of interesting. And guess what? K2P channels, a certain group of them, called TASC subgroup, they call them this, is that they are pH sensitive. So you lower the pH of the hydrogen ion, and they close. And if they close, the cells depolarize. Guess where they're high in? Carotid bodies. Wow, it all comes full circle, isn't that wild? So you just look at through the history and how this progressed, and then they found out, oh, that is possibly part of the reason those cells depolarize and they release chemicals like neurotransmitters, glutamate, acetylcholine, and the sensory neurons next to your carotid bodies detect those chemicals and they go to your brain and fire and say, you need to breathe faster, right? Because your CO2 is probably increased and your pH has dropped, but also inside those cells, they're hypoxic sensitive, and that'll change their electrical activity too. So we can actually go into just how your carotid bodies work if you want to, cells, and go into a little bit more depth, and maybe pull in some of Putnam's work. But then at the cell level, we want to understand those mechanisms, so it happens to be the main point is these K2P channels. So maybe some people, you know, more hypoxic sensitive. Where does this come into play clinically, do you think? And now this is where people are targeted. Have you heard about sudden death syndrome babies? What is it? There's another word for it. I'm forgetting the name.
Is it SIDS?
Yes, SIDS. Yeah, sudden infant death syndrome. Okay. SIDS is an acronym. Very good. Thank you. So they're trying to study, why do babies all of a sudden die, right? And it's a problem. In California, there's a state law that any baby that dies like this, they actually are investigated if it was SIDS or if the, you know, something else happened, like, you know, if someone suffocated the child. So they actually go through an investigation with this. And there's a group in Massachusetts that actually, if a baby dies and they find out about it, they say, could you please send, you know, could you still please send the brain to us? We want to look at the expression levels. We want to look at their carotid bodies. We want to find out if they weren't as sensitive. And maybe that's the rationale they stopped breathing. Because you can imagine, if you're not that sensitive, then you might not be driven to breathe. And so they're wondering if it's a genetic problem. And could be, right? So they're trying to investigate more and more about that. So it's kind of interesting. So it relates right to a clinical aspect and trying to understand SIDS. And you think about, now we can address it maybe on the K2P level expression, right? And the subtype. And then you think, well, thank you, yeast, you know? Yeast to humans, to a disease, SIDS. That's just really quite amazing, right? Cool, really cool stuff. So guess what they were doing at Wright State? There's another group that was up there working on SIDS because of the connection with the turtles and everything else. So that's really, really neat, you know, the whole aspect. And there's another big group at Dartmouth University, at the medical school at Dartmouth, that's working on SIDS and working on this hypoxia problem on the carotid bodies and seeing if there's more problems with that, and they can pinpoint what might be the issue or the cause of it. So you see what's going on, but on a comparative aspect, this is why you need funding, you need researchers in everything, right? Genetics, bioinformatics, yeast researchers, human researchers, turtle researchers, and pull it together. And this is one another aspect about why meetings are really important, scientific meetings, because that's where you share ideas, right, in publications and can read about it. Okay, my aspects on that aspect. So I just found that to be amazing about leaky channels. And, oh yeah, and we've talked a little bit about brown fat before, right? And that how you can use the brown fat to actually increase your metabolism, raise your body temperature, right? Babies have the brown fat between the shoulder blades, right? Basically to maintain their body temperature. Bats use brown fat to break down. And it's basically going through and just, like in this picture here, actually there's the ability to use those fats and those lipids and go through, and actually here's your mitochondria, right? It will break down this to the fatty acids, and actually then this, what was the name of it? Tegin? Did I pronounce it right? Tegin? Oh, thermogen. It increases, and that allows the fat, this hydrogen ions to go through, and if that happens, you can help make more ATP. So this is really quite an interesting process as well. So that's pretty neat. And the last part of this chapter was talking about these stink bugs, basically, or the bombardier beetle, right, that can discharge this toxic kind of alarm substance, if you will, but actually a nauseous substance, but it's also warm. So that doesn't really help the animal to warm its body, but it's actually warm in the sense of relaying that toxic chemical, but that's also a nauseous stimulus for any prey that might be around this animal. So interesting that that takes energy as well, right? So that's kind of into that chapter, just giving you different aspects that how metabolism is utilized, right, and different things. Body temperature, making a nauseous substance, like in this beetle, utilizing brown fat, and how all this comes about, why do we have metabolism? Probably a lot of us to keep your body temperature going too, but also we need to make proteins, and we need to function, right? We need to build proteins, we need to do things like this too, and keep ion transport going. So what we could do, I think that would probably go in well. Maybe it's better to talk about membrane physiology before we get into temperature, because then we can see how temperature relates with membrane physiology. We already covered some aspects with temperature. What was the main thing with temperature that we talked about with pH? Does anybody remember? What happens with water, distilled water, if you raise the temperature? Does it change pH? Can we talk about that? Right. The misconception that's taught a lot is that it's always going to stay 7.0, right? But it doesn't, right? Because we break it down, right? It's water. And when you think about animals, because pH, the equation is not just pH equals a negative log. It's pH times equals the negative log times the activity coefficient, right? So that activity coefficient is a disassociation of whatever ion you're talking about. So let's hit the lights here. So what we can do next, my lecture is as chaotic as it normally is, but even with you here, so isn't it? Yeah, it's chaotic. I'm gonna have to up my ante now. So let's think about what we just talked about, the membrane. Okay. I think we all seen these kind of pictures before. And we can get started on this, but we'll just start to think about it. Right? Biliping membrane. So what's really interesting is if you just take free fatty acids, they have a head, right, a polar head, like the thought makers that are up there that are polar. We can show some pictures next time. I'll get a real lecture together with PowerPoints. And then they're long carbon chains, right, which are don't really have any charges, so they're hydrophobic, so that's why they'll come together. But if you just take fatty acids and you put them together in water, what happens is they form a micelle, which is really quite cool. So it's just these. See my drawings. So they can form this micelle type of structure, right? Because this would be like that. That's pretty neat. And they think this is the beginning of how cells are made a long time ago, right? Is that if you have fatty acids, they will spontaneously form that. But then we have the bilipid membrane means on both sides. So this would be, you know, all the way around, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So to get inside the cell, like we were just talking about, we have leak channels. And two common ones, we'll just group this big group together, is we have a sodium leak channel, which basically allows sodium into cells. And then we have a potassium leak channel, where potassium leaks out. And we call these K2P channels. And we call these sodium channels called NALCN. That's pretty wild. NA, so sodium leak channel. Not bad. But this one's a little confusing, K2P channels. But there's a big family of K2P channels. So you have like 15, drosophila, 11 different types in the genome. Who knows about alternative splicing? Could be more, but that's kind of interesting. So these are leak channels, and there's a big family of these. There's not such a big family of these. There are not that many of them. So this is what is going across your cell leaking. But the cells generally have a, what's the membrane potential of a cell? What do you generally kind of think about? -70. The other ideas? It varies, exactly. This is what you think. It depends. Exactly. It was a trick question. So anytime you get these things, you're going to start off, it depends, right? Because your cardiac cells, your pacemaker cells up here, if you stab those, they don't really have resting membrane potential because they're pacing all that, -20. So it's just in your heart, -20. You go down to your ventricular contractile muscles, -60, -70. Wow. That's a big difference. It's the same tissue. It's the heart, right? So it depends. That's the take home. Squid axon, which you see in medtech books, they tell you about the resting membrane potential, and they start off with -90. I just love it. It's a medtech book, -90. Squid axon, right? We're not squid, right? So this is, and so why would it be negative? As far as I know, every cell has that's living is basically a negative potential, negative resting membrane potential. So why is it that way? What's the general take home of this? Why do we have a potential? Why is one side different than the other side? Because of?
Ion differences.
Ion differences, right? That there's some ion differences across that membrane. Because if we take a sodium ion over here, theoretically, and move it over here, there's going to be a voltage change, right? If we have more sodiums over here than we have over here, that's going to be more positive than over here. So you get the idea, right? So let's look at these cells and try to think about what's going on in my cell. Well, that didn't go very well. Okay. So they used to do this in analytical chemistry classes, but I don't think they do it anymore. You can put in like sodium on one side, maybe chloride on one side, right? And you have water and water. And you put this in one side, and what's going to happen is it's going to diffuse across, right? It's going to diffuse this way, and chloride's going to diffuse this way. It's going to disassociate in the water, right? Sodium chloride, salt, right? And it's going to diffuse, and over time, you have equal concentrations, right? On both sides. So equal concentrations. If you threw in something like, and you might have done these experiments, like sucrose, for example, or some sugar, some large molecule that couldn't go across, so it couldn't go across, what happens is you end up with, you know, osmotic differences, right? This will drop, this will go up, right? Because of osmosis, right? So, I mean, the water being pulled to try to dilute the concentration. So that's another, you know, something to think about across cells, right? Because you don't want your cell to expand, bust, right? Or shrink. That's kind of interesting. So let's look at something else, though, with this. Let's put in something like anions. And usually we refer to these as proteins, because proteins generally have a negative charge. Anybody run the Western blot, you know, electrophoresis or something, right? Rhino cells, you put a pole down here, it's attracted to the positive pole because the proteins migrate through the agar gel,
proteins generally have a negative charge. So then you end up with a more of a negative charge over here. They're large. They don't want to go across this membrane, this little frit that you might have in your analytical chemistry class. So what's going to happen now? You have more negative charge over here than you do over there. So what's going to happen? Well, chlorides doesn't like that negative charge, so you're going to get more chloride over here, right? Chloride concentration is going to be higher over here. And remember, this is concentration, that little symbol. So chloride concentration is going to be higher over here than it is here. But sodium now? We've got kind of a trade-off here. We started off with more sodium, but this is negative charge, so it's going to pull that over. So hopefully you think it might balance off in time, right? So maybe the sodium's balanced off in time. So now you think about yourself, right? If we wanted to do something different, let's do another one of these wonderful analytical chemistry experiments. Okay, I was tortured in analytical chemistry in undergrad. But anyways, you could take wires, you could put a wire in there, right? And you could have a charge difference. And now you could put sodium chloride in one side, right? And what's going to happen here, right? Is the chloride going to be attracted to the negative pole? No. So now we end up with chloride over here, higher than we have chloride over here, right? The concentration. And what's going to happen to the sodium? Sodium's going to be one over here more. So now we have a sodium imbalance that's higher than here. All right. So now we've got a charge balance that's different because of this electrical balance that we set up. So the take home here is it's not just the concentration, it's the electrochemical difference across the cell membrane that gives rise to the membrane potential. So the key word is electrochemical gradient, and that's what drives the cell difference. So it's not just the concentration gradient, it's not just the electrical gradient, it's the electrochemical gradient. So if a cell is more negative, then say by definition, and this is just the way they started it off, is by definition they started this off. So it's sometimes a little confusing. So they have an electrode on the outside of a cell, drawn like this with a ground wire, and then this is an amplifier, right? And you stab inside the cell with this amplifier, and it can measure the difference. You might have some negative value, let's say minus 60 millivolts, you know, just as an example. I don't want you to memorize the number, so, okay. So, by definition, it's named on the outside as zero potential. So they could have, a long time ago, say, oh, by definition we'll start with the inside zero, and everything would be the other way around in the way we calculate this. But this is the way it was defined by being outside zero in reference to the inside of the cell. So this is a negative potential. It can vary, depends on the cell, but why is it so negative? Well, a lot of it is due to, we have a lot more leak for potassium than we do sodium. And this is what we're gonna work out. So how can you determine that? How do you determine this electrical driving force between the ions and how it works? It's the Nernst equation. So you can think of it in different ways. We can think of it for a particular ion. Whatever the ion is, and you can actually work that out. So it's for that ion, whatever X, RT over ZF, LN, out over in, or one side compared to the other. Let's work this out for potassium or sodium, and see if we can work this out. What are these other terms in here? R is a gas constant, T is in temperature in Kelvin. I know you've heard about your chemistry, but back to haunt you. F is Faraday's constant, Z is the charge of the ion. Okay? So, and LN, we want to convert this to log base 10, it's a little bit easier to deal with it all. So that would be 2.303 times all this, whatever it is that you want to work out, in a log concentration difference. So let's just give some values for sodium. All right? So let's just play with sodium. And let's just get the main idea. And not have to worry about all this right now. But the main idea is right here, because this will be constant. So sodium on the outside of your cells generally is higher than the inside. So like 120. And this might be 10 millimolar. So anybody got a calculator on them? What if you took 120 over 10? Somebody have a calculator? 20 over 10, and then do the log of that. And let's see what happens. It's log base 10. If you turn sideways, sometimes.
0.3.
Yeah. 0.3. That's good. And that's in volts. So 30 millivolts. Or if you wanted to work this out, it's like 0.3. It's a plus charge, is what I wanted to work it out. And it depends on this factors in here, too. So this all depends on what we're talking about with temperature. But it's a positive value. Let's try doing it the other way. What if you took potassium, and potassium's high inside the cells compared to outside? Let's do it the other way. 120, let's just say potassium on the outside is like 5, which would be, you know, in the right range. So 5 divided by 120, log base 10.
-1.3.
Some negative value. The point I'm trying to make is if you had a higher concentration of that ion on the inside than you did the outside, you get a negative value. If you have a higher concentration on the outside than you did the inside, you get a positive value. If we work all this out, and we'll deal with this coming up, right? It, the Nernst equation. For sodium, generally, in mammalian cells or amphibian cells, for the sodium, this value for sodium will equal about 1/3. For potassium, might be somewhere around minus, it depends on the temperature and everything else that we're talking about. Let's say around minus 70 millivolts. So this is after we worked out RT over ZF, all right? So I'm not putting that in there right now. But around, if we worked all that out for us mammalian cells, we generally get E sodium for the single ion around maybe plus 130, and for E potassium around some negative value like minus 70. What does this mean? We're going to rehash this a little bit. This is the equilibrium potential for that ion. That means if you had this cell at 130 millivolts across here, we would have no driving gradient for sodium. If we're at minus 70 across here, we'll have no driving gradient for potassium alone. Because if this was so negative, minus 70, it pulls potassium in. So that's kind of interesting. And if we had this so positive at plus 130 across here, this would be so positive it would keep sodium out, right? So this is what's called the equilibrium potential for that one ion. The problem is,